The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
On today's show, we're talking about new revelations in the Globe and Mail that developer Peter Wall, a major real estate mogul in the city of Vancouver, donated $1 million to the Vancouver Police Foundation, and it was in the context of increasing policing resources in the downtown east side because of his perception that Vancouver's harm reduction and housing policies had failed and that policing was needed. We'll talk to Meenakshi Minot today, criminalization and policing campaigner with Pivot Legal Society, about that and a year of police advocacy through the Black Lives Matter, Defund the Police, and the Neighborhood Street Disorder Unit, which her group complained about and which was shut down only 6 weeks after launch. Here's Meenakshi Minot with Pivot Legal Society. Meenakshi, great to have you back on The Pulse here on Co-op Radio.
Thanks so much for having me today, David.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that you've been such a regular guest on our program. We've been going for 1 year now.
Wow, congrats on the 1 year mark. It's nice to know there's a news show back on Co-op with regular timing.
Totally, and of course our listeners probably know you from your show, Stark Raven, that it comes on once a month, I believe.
Yes, it's been on hiatus during COVID for many of the reasons we're going to get into today.
You co-authored an article this week in the media with Harsha Walia of the BC Civil Liberties Association called We Can Choose Differently, Safety Beyond Police, Prisons, and Criminalization. So this sounds like the work that we've been interviewing you about for a year, about five times, I think, and also the work that sounds like it's kept you pretty busy.
It's absolutely been chaos for folks who are criminalized amidst COVID. And that is all levels of criminalization, whether we're looking at folks like Khalil Seawright in Toronto, who is facing legal action from the city for constructing tiny homes, folks who are incarcerated and facing deplorable conditions or COVID outbreaks in both provincial and federal prisons, and then folks who are now subject to a very confusing set of police interactions under the guise of public health guidelines.
Yes. Now, the guy you mentioned in Toronto, he's a carpenter, and he built these cute little, very simple kind of plywood homes for the cold snap. But not only were the homes seized and destroyed, the authorities are actually trying to prosecute him.
Yeah, and it's pretty disgusting, right, when you think about the costs that go into any kind of legal action. And we're in this moment, right, where we're really talking about defunding and redirecting public funds from police and prisons. But we can also look at how the funds that the City of Toronto is using to take Khalil to court could absolutely be used to support people who are actually experiencing homelessness and relying on public space.
It should also be noted that Khalil is also a Black man, which I think really ties into just how the police differentially weigh and attack certain people.
Mm-hmm. The police, and let's not leave Mayor John Tory out of this either.
Mm-hmm. Now, out in Vancouver, the similar problems are playing out. Tell me a little bit about what you see connects a city like Toronto with the police in Vancouver, because sometimes I think people get away with thinking that they're somehow different on a fundamental level.
Absolutely. And so, you know, in Vancouver, we've had a number of tent cities that have been established during the time of COVID following the evacuation order at Oppenheimer Park last year. You know, almost immediately after, we saw a tent city crop up at Crab Park in the parking lot. And then after that, folks were displaced and went to Strathcona Park, where they have been organizing and living in what they call Kennedy Trudeau Tent City. And, you know, beyond these larger tent cities, we also know that people continue to rely on public space and maybe living in their cars or living rough but outside of the public eye and public scrutiny. And again, these are not unique to Vancouver or Toronto or just urban centers. For many reasons, people have faced increased precarity during COVID. And that includes housing instability. And on top of that, we know that communities continue to also organize in, you know, reactionary ways around the unsheltered neighbors.
Well, I wanted to talk about that because Strathcona Park sparked a lot of neighbor concerns and also people from Westside homeowner groups kind of coming into Strathcona with accusations of increased crime and violence in the neighborhood. And it created last year, if people remember, that street disorder unit from the VPD, a dedicated unit to the downtown East Dighton, Strathcona. You spoke out very strongly at Pivot Legal, and so did the BC Civil Liberties against that. And within only weeks, the police department claimed it had done its work and wrapped it up. Do you think that's the real story as to why they closed it so quickly?
Absolutely not. And so the team that you're describing, the neighborhood response team, was designed by the VPD to respond to, quote, lower priority, low level, and even non-criminal calls. It was going to be deployed in five neighborhoods, the downtown entertainment district, as well as Chinatown, Gastown, Downtown Eastside, and Strathcona. At no point did the Vancouver Police Department say that this was a temporary or pilot program. But once there was an immense amount of outcry and a formal complaint submitted by Pivot alongside VANDU and the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, the program, very interestingly, concluded after about 6 weeks and it was tied up.
It was so fast. They sent a big press release. A success. We're closing it down.
Exactly. And you know, again, this is part of the ongoing criminalization of people who rely on public space. So you see the police department itself says that they're designing a team that's not responding to, quote, criminal issues, but really nuisance issues. And, you know, if you unpack what nuisance actually means, it often just refers to people who are visibly poor. And they may be under awnings or on sidewalks or on benches or in parks. And there's really no reason that the police should be getting involved. That's part of like the bigger work around the defund movement that's taken hold in Vancouver. But once you start to label those behaviors as criminal, it creates a certain narrative, especially in more mainstream media or NIMBY type communities.
I wondered, I mean, I can't say for sure if there's any connection between that unit and this controversy over a developer's donation to the police foundation, but I wanted to ask you about that, Menakshi, because the Globe and Mail revealed last week that Peter Wall, who's a massive condo developer, real estate mogul in the city, gave $1 million to the police foundation in Vancouver, which provides equipment and training and programs that the police rely on. And it was going to these community policing centers that largely are based around some of these low-income neighborhoods. What do you think about that?
Thank you so much for asking about that, David, because I really want to highlight what this donation signifies to myself as someone who advocates around policing. So, you know, and, you know, there's nothing unique or special about me. I just have a certain job that means I have to focus on this occupying force constantly. But if I wanted to influence police policy, I have very few avenues to do that. I can request to speak to the police board as a delegation, and I might be granted that wish, and I could have up to 5 minutes and no time for questions or comments. And right now, it's calling in, so there's not even the ability to make like a visual or kind of multimedia presentation. I could try to write to the VPD and submit a service and policy complaint internally. I could try to lobby a complaint through the media or through social media. But I certainly don't have the ability to make a donation and basically design a policing strategy, which is effectively what Peter Wall's donation does.
Tell us a bit about that, because he gave to this Vancouver Police Foundation. It's allegedly separate legally from the police department, and it says it doesn't set priorities for policing, but you can pick the area, the neighborhood you want policed.
So tell me how that is not a priority for policing. Tell me how that identifying a neighborhood where you want to create policing, even if it is, quote, community policing, how is that different than different or distinct from actually setting out a priority for the police board. Like that, frankly, makes no sense.
It's interesting because the mayor claims he has even less control than that over the actual police board, which he chairs. Like, that's like, I don't think the mayor can say, I want policing in this neighborhood. I don't think the mayor is even allowed to say that.
Totally. And, you know, we have city council that unanimously voted on the decriminalizing poverty motion. It said that we don't want to continue this law enforcement approach, right? They wrote to the Vancouver Police Vancouver Police Board, which, again, is distinct from city council. They wrote to the police board, identified this. They said that it's a stated priority in the mandate of city council. Yet then you have this, again, third distinct organization being the Vancouver Police Foundation, which is able to receive a $1 million donation from a local developer and establish increased community policing, despite that program not being a stated priority of city council, which, you know, there's a piece around how confusing it is to ask us, the people in power here, right? And city council is a very imperfect colonial product of, you know, it's a colonial vestige, but still people have more ability to speak at council, to sign up and speak, to not have to go through a delegation process. And certainly you don't need $1 million to make your voice known at council proceedings. Whether your voice is able to translate into action is a different question. But I think that Peter Wall's donation really highlights how influential money is.
I wanted to read a statement from Peter Wall to the Globe and Mail and have you react to it. He says, and let's remember, he is one of the biggest real estate developers in the city, like in the top three biggest condo developers. He says, quote, Vancouver's current city officials' answer to the homeless problem for the people on the downtown east side is to buy up or rent dilapidated old hotels that are rodent infested, lack proper plumbing and heating. And their answer to mental health and addiction problems is to open more injection sites throughout the city where adults and youth can bring their contraband drugs, which kill them. That's his explanation for why he wanted to devote more policing to the downtown east side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a laughable statement. If I was in a laughing mood, I would laugh. But it's also very much a dog whistle for all of the NIMBY forces in the city, folks like Safer Vancouver or Yale Town Residents Against Basic Humanity. I don't know the names that they operate under. But it's very much, like, his comments and his statement are very much designed to create the sense of panic and lawlessness. And again, let's be clear, dilapidated SROs are not an appropriate solution to a housing crisis, nor is institutionalization. And safe consumption sites are very important. They're important in the context of the nearly 5 years of the drug poisoning crisis that we've lived in. And I know Karen Ward has come on the show repeatedly to talk about that. It's one part of the solution, as are things like access to safe supply, peer-led safe supply. And for Peter Wall to really malign those efforts in his statement, I think shows that he's not particularly interested in keeping communities safe. And this, again, goes back to what people are saying. If you want safer communities, actually resource those communities. Don't police them.
And of course, as a journalist, I do have to fact check his statement that the injection sites where youth and adults bring their contraband drugs, which kill them. In fact, there's been no deaths in any of the safe injection or consumption sites in Vancouver. The deaths are people who don't get the opportunity to use those places.
Yes, and when he's saying, you know, it's really this moralistic panic around substance use, around young people using substances. And we know that young people are using substances. And we know that, tragically, there are young people who use poison drugs and die. I think that there are many youth and, like, youth drug organizers who could speak to the solutions that would actually work. I'm thinking of folks like Callie Sedgemore, who is a member of the Coalition of Peers Dismantling the Drug War, who was part of the advocacy against the provincial bill that was effectively going to detain youth in the hospital if they showed up and were overdosing.
I mean, it sounds like to you quite an injustice about this, the fact that this donation system even exists. Like, did you know about that before?
I didn't know, but I also think that these are not unusual. I know several years ago, there was a community policing center established in Strathcona. And at that time, the police department used the drug poisoning crisis as a reason to create it. I'm outraged, but I'm also kind of like, I have to throw my hands up at some point because, you know, we have the impact of the drug war in a community like the Downtown East Side. I don't think people are saying we don't want to be safe, but we really have to understand what safety looks like. And when I think about, you know, the function of like a community policing center, it's like pretty clean cut volunteers walking around in high-vis gear. I just like really struggle to understand how people think that actually translates into greater safety for the folks who are living in Strathcona or living in the Downtown East Side. Like, it's just farcical.
You mentioned real safety, and you mentioned in your province op-ed with Harsha that there are, quote, immediate solutions available to both levels of government right now, that there is a ground wall of support for these. What are some of the things, the actual solutions that you're saying here?
Decriminalize drugs. It's that easy. De facto decriminalization at the municipal and provincial level. Lobby the federal government for the actual decriminalization, which only the federal government can make. To me, that's a very simple solution. It's something that people have been calling for years, and the provincial NDP government has really failed to take meaningful action on it. There are other, like, very tangible solutions right now. Create a binding police standard that outlaws the use of street stops. We know that they are harming Black and Indigenous folks. We know that they are used as a tool of racist policing. Just stop. You know, like, these aren't, like, multi-year pilot projects that require blah, 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 blah. Like, they're very tangible, simple things that actually have been on the government's radar for many years. Create funding for people to actually submit and follow through on complaints through the Office of the Police Complaint Commissioner or for survivors to receive support throughout investigations done by the IIO of BC.
One of the things that we've heard this last few weeks is, you know, a lot of people had hoped that the federal government's big announcement was going to be about decriminalization. In the end, it was about ending mandatory minimum sentences for simple nonviolent drug possession. A lot of people have criticized that as being inadequate. What's your thoughts on it?
So mandatory minimums have been found to be non-constitutional. So it's great that they are being outlawed and that this bill seeks to get rid of them.
Only for certain crimes, of course.
And, you know, I don't think that really merits a celebratory press release when the government meets its own obligation to uphold the Constitution. And as you point out, mandatory minimums have only been found to be non-constitutional in certain, like, with certain crimes. When I'm thinking about some of the advocacy that's being done on behalf of, quote, like, violent offenders or folks who are automatically sentenced to life if they are convicted of murder, particularly thinking of women and Indigenous women who are disproportionately subject to that regime.
You mentioned at the end of your column, and I hadn't heard of this before, a new declaration that PIVOT and other organizations have signed on to called Choosing Real Safety. It's a historic declaration to divest from policing and prisons and build safer communities for all. Tell me a little bit about this declaration.
Sure, and it's online at choosingrealsafety.com. This statement has been developed and authored by folks who are involved in the Abolition Coalition, which kind of is a network of people organizing around prison justice across so-called Canada. And the Choosing Real Safety historic declaration served as an opportunity for folks who may be doing related but not necessarily connected or networked work to show the strength of their organizing through revealing the network of folks who are doing this. So if you go to choosingrealsafety.com, there's a map, and again, through that, you can get a sense of, like, the geography of signatories. I believe when I last checked, there were about 17 organizations in D.C. that had signed on. That included Pivot Legal Society, as well as a couple of other organizations in both so-called Vancouver and so-called Victoria. And this declaration, I think, is another invitation to people to really take their outrage, their desire for a new paradigm, and start to think about what that would look like. So we're hearing about defunding the police. We're hearing about the situation in prisons across Canada, whether that's immigration detention facilities, provincial or federal prisons. Choosing Real Safety is about looking to divest from policing and prisons and build safer communities for all. No longer relying on law enforcement or criminalization or control, really, as the way to create safer communities.
Now, there are now 177 organizations across the country signed on to it. What to you is the sort of historic or significance of tying together prisons and policing and immigration holds into one campaign like this?
So I think that a lot of the times, those three institutions are seen as different or distinct, right? We're calling for defunding the police, or folks are rallying in the streets because of police violence. Last year, myself and other folks from Vancouver Prison Justice State Committee were making noise outside of prisons to protest the outbreaks inside. And then, you know, within immigration detention facilities, folks are, again, organizing around the people who are being held in those facilities or the people who are being deported by that regime. And ultimately, all of those structures do rely on police in some form, whether it's the form of a police officer, a prison guard, a border guard. I think the declaration gives us the invitation to really connect those carceral strings and see these as institutions that are mutually informing each other. And in our resistance, we need to be informed by all of them in tandem.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, Menakshi. Anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, thank you again for having me on the Pulse today, David.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. Take good care. Menakshi Mano is criminalization and policing campaigner with Pivot Legal Society. You can find the Choosing Real Safety Declaration at choosingrealsafety.com.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.